Fantastic Audio presents Tales of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin. Read by Scott Brick, Gabrielle DeCure, Amanda Carr, Stefan Rudnicki, and Ursula K. Le Guin.
The Finder. This is the first page of the Book of the Dark, written long ago in Hardic runes. After Alfarin and Morid perished, and the Isle of Solea sank beneath the sea, the Council of the Wise governed for the child Sariath, until he took the throne. His reign was bright, but brief. The kings who followed him in Enlad were seven, and their realm increased in peace and wealth. Then the dragons came to raid among the western lands, and wizards went out in vain against them. King Akambar moved the court from Berala in Enlad to the city of Havnor, whence he sent out his fleet against the invaders from the Kargad lands and drove them back into the east. But still they sent raiding ships even as far as the inmost sea. The last of the kings was Meherrion, who made peace both with the dragons and the Kargs, but at great cost. And after the Ring of the Runes was broken, and Aerith Akbi died with the great dragon, and Meherrion the Brave was killed by treachery, it seemed that no good thing happened in the archipelago. Many claimed Meherrion's throne, but none could keep it, and the quarrels of the claimants divided all loyalties. No commonwealth was left, and no justice, only the will of the wealthy. Men of noble houses, merchants, and pirates, any who could hire soldiers and wizards called himself lord, claiming lands and cities as his property. The warlords made those they conquered slaves, and those they hired were in truth slaves, having only their masters to safeguard them from rival warlords seizing the lands and sea pirates raiding the ports, and bands and hordes of lawless, miserable men dispossessed of their living, driven by hunger to raid and rob. The Book of the Dark, written late in the time it tells of, is a compilation of self-contradictory histories, partial biographies, and garbled legends. But it's the best of the records that survived the dark years. Wanting praise, not history, the warlords burnt the books in which the poor and powerless might learn what power is. But when the lore books of a wizard came into a warlord's hands, he was likely to treat them with caution, locking them away to keep them harmless, or giving them to a wizard in his hired to do with as he wished. In the margins of the spells and word lists, and in the end papers of these books of lore, a wizard or his prentice might record a plague, a famine, a raid, a change of masters, along with the spells worked in such events and their success or unsuccess. Such random records reveal a clear moment here and there, though all between those moments is darkness. They are like glimpses of a lighted ship far out at sea, in the rain, at night. And there are songs, old lays and ballads from small islands, and from the quiet uplands of Havnor, that tell the story of those years. Havnor Greatport is the city at the heart of the world, white-towered above its bay. On the tallest tower the sword of Aerith Akbi catches the first and last of daylight. Through that city passes all the trade and commerce and learning and craft of Earthsea, a wealth not hoarded. There the king sits, having returned after the healing of the ring, in sign of healing. And in that city, in these latter days, men and women of the islands speak with dragons, in sign of change. But Havnor is also the great isle, a broad, rich land, and in the villages inland from the port, the farmlands of the slopes of Mount On, nothing ever changes much. There, a song worth singing is likely to be sung again. There, old men at the tavern talk of Morid as if they had known him when they too were young and heroes. There, girls walking out to fetch the cows home tell stories of the women of the hand, who are forgotten everywhere else in the world, even on Roke, but remembered among those silent, sunlit roads and fields, and in the kitchens by the hearths where the housewives work and talk. In the time of the kings, mages gathered in the court of Enlad, and later in the court of Havnor, to counsel the king and take counsel together, using their arts to pursue goals they agreed were good. But in the dark years, wizards sold their skills to the highest bidder, pitting their powers one against the other in duels and combats of sorcery, careless of the evils they did, or worse than careless. Plagues and famines, the failure of springs of water, summers with no rain and years with no summer, the birth of sickly and monstrous young to sheep and cattle, the birth of sickly and monstrous children to the people of the isles. All these things were charged to the practices of wizards and witches, and all too often, rightly so. So it became dangerous to practice sorcery unless you were under the protection of a strong warlord. And even then, if you met up with a wizard whose powers were greater than your own, you might be destroyed. If you let down your guard among the common folk, they too might destroy you if they could, seeing you as the source of the worst evils they suffered, a malign being. In those years, in the minds of most people, all magic was black. It was then that village sorcery, and above all, women's witchery, came into the ill repute that has clung to it since. Witches paid dearly for practicing the arts they thought of as their own, the care of pregnant beasts and women, birthing, teaching the songs and rites, the fertility and order of field and garden, the building and care of the house and its furniture, the mining of ores and metals, had always been in the charge of women. A great rich lore of spells and charms to ensure the good outcome of these matters was shared among the witches. But when things went wrong at the birth or in the field, that would be the witch's fault. And things went wrong more often than right, with the wizards warring, using poisons and curses recklessly to gain immediate advantage without thought for what followed after. They brought drought and storm, blights and fires and sickness across the land, and the village witch was punished for them. She didn't know why her charm of healing had caused the wound to gangrene, why the child she brought into the world was imbecile, why her blessing seemed to burn the seed in the furrows and blight the apple on the tree. But for these ills, somebody was to blame, and the witch or the sorcerer was there, right there in the village or the town, not off in the warlord's castle or fort protected by armed men and spells of defense. Sorcerers and witches were drowned in the poisoned wells, burned in the withered fields, buried alive to make the dead earth rich again. So the practice of all their lore and the teaching of it had become perilous. Those who undertook it were often those already outcast, crippled, deranged, without family, old women and men who had little to lose. The wise man and wise woman, trusted and held in reverence, gave way to the stock figures of the shuffling, impotent village sorcerer with his trickeries, and the hag witch with her potions used in aid of lust, jealousy, and malice. And a child's gift for magic became a thing to dread and hide. This is a tale of those times. Some of it is taken from the Book of the Dark, and some comes from Havnor, from the upland farms of On and the woodlands of Faliarn. A story may be pieced together from such scraps and fragments, and though it will be an airy quilt, half made of hearsay and half of guesswork, yet it may be true enough. It's a tale of the founding of Roke, and if the masters of Roke say it didn't happen so, let them tell us how it happened otherwise. For a cloud hangs over the time when Roke first became the Isle of the Wise, and it may be that the wise men put it there. There was an otter in our brook that every mortal semblance took. Could any spell of magic make and speak the tongues of man and drake? So runs the water away, away, so runs the water away. Otter was the son of a boatwright who worked in the shipyards of Havnor Greatport. His mother gave him his country name. She was a farm woman from Endlane Village, around northwest of Mount On. She had come to the city seeking work, as many came. Decent folk in a decent trade in troubled times, the boatwright and his family were anxious not to come to notice lest they come to grief. And so, when it became clear that the boy had a gift of magery, His father tried to beat it out of him. "You might as well beat a cloud for raining," said Otter's mother. "Take care you don't beat evil into him," said his aunt. "Take care he doesn't turn your belt on you with a spell," said his uncle. But the boy played no tricks against his father. He took his beatings in silence and learned to hide his gift. It didn't seem to him to amount to much. It was such an easy matter to him to make a silvery light shine in a dark room, or find a lost pin by thinking about it, or true up a warped joint by running his hands over the wood and talking to it, that he couldn't see why they made a fuss over such things. But his father raged at him for his shortcuts, even struck him once on the mouth when he was talking to the work, and made him do his carpentry with tools, in silence. His mother tried to explain. "It's as if you'd found some great jewel," she said. "And what's one of us to do with a diamond but hide it? Anybody rich enough to buy it from you is strong enough to kill you for it. Keep it hid, and keep away from great people and their crafty men." Crafty men is how they spoke of wizards in those days. One of the gifts of power is to know power. Wizard knows wizard, unless the concealment is very skillful. And the boy had no skills at all, except in boat building, of which he was a promising scholar by the age of 12. About that time, the midwife, who had helped his mother at his birth, came by and said to his parents, "Let Otter come to me in the evenings after work. He should learn the songs and be prepared for his naming day." That was all right, for she had done the same for Otter's elder sister, and so his parents sent him to her in the evenings. But she taught Otter more than the song of the creation. She and some men and women like her, people of no fame and some of questionable reputation, had all in some degree a gift of magery, and they shared, in secret, what lore and craft they had. "A gift untaught is a ship unguided," they said to Otter, and they taught him all they knew. It wasn't much, but there were some beginnings of the great arts in it, and though he felt uneasy at deceiving his parents, he couldn't resist this knowledge and the kindness and praise of his poor teachers. "It will do you no harm if you never use it for harm," they told him, and that was easy for him to promise them. At the stream Serenen that runs outside the western wall of the city, the midwife gave Otter his true name, by which he is remembered in islands far from Havnor. Among these people was an old man whom they called, among themselves, the Changer. He showed Otter a few spells of illusion, and when the boy was 15 or so, the old man took him out into the fields by Serenen to show him the one spell of true change he knew. "First, let's see you turn that bush into the seeming of a tree," he said, and promptly Otter did so. Illusion came so easy to the boy that the old man took alarm. Otter had to beg and wheedle him for any further teaching, and finally to promise him, swearing on his own true and secret name, that if he learned the changer's great spell, he would never use it but to save a life, his own or another's. Then the old man taught it to him. But it wasn't much use, Otter thought, since he had to hide it. What he learned working with his father and uncle in the shipyard he could use, at least. And he was becoming a good craftsman. Even his father would admit that. Loson, a sea pirate who called himself King of the Inmost Sea, was then chief warlord in the city and all the east and south of Havnor. Exacting tribute from that rich domain, he spent it to increase his soldiery and the fleets he sent out to take slaves and plunder from other lands. As Otter's uncle said, he kept the shipwrights busy. They were grateful to have work in a time when men seeking work found only beggary, and rats ran in the courts of Meherian. They did an honest job, Otter's father said, and what the work was used for was none of their concern. But the other learning he had been given had made Otter touchy in these matters, delicate of conscience. The big galley they were building now would be rowed to war by Loson's slaves, and would bring back slaves as cargo. It galled him to think of the good ship in that vicious usage. "Why can't we build fishing boats the way we used to?" he said. And his father said, "Because the fishermen can't pay us." "Can't pay us as well as Loson does, but we could live," Otter argued. You think I can turn the king's order down? You want to see me sent to row with the slaves in the galley we're building? Use your head, boy! So Otter worked along with them with a clear head and an angry heart. They were in a trap. What was the use of a gift of power, he thought, if not to get out of a trap? His conscience as a craftsman would not let him fault the carpentry of the ship in any way, but his conscience as a wizard told him he could put a hex on her, a curse woven right into her beams and hull. Surely that was using the secret art to a good end. For harm, yes, but only to harm the harmful. He did not talk to his teachers about it. If he was doing wrong, it was none of their fault, and they would know nothing about it. He thought about it for a long time, working out how to do it, making the spell very carefully. It was the reversal of a finding charm, a losing charm, he called it to himself. The ship would float, and handle well, and steer, but she would never steer quite true. It was the best he could do in protest against the misuse of good work and a good ship. He was pleased with himself. When the ship was launched, and all seemed well with her, for her fault would not show up until she was out on the open sea, he could not keep from his teachers what he had done. The little circle of old men and midwives, the young hunchback who could speak with the dead, the blind girl who knew the names of things. He told them his trick, and the blind girl laughed, but the old people said, "Look out, take care, keep hidden." In Loson's service was a man who called himself Hound, because, as he said, he had a nose for witchery. His employment was to sniff Loson's food, and drink, and garments, and women, anything that might be used by enemy wizards against him, and also to inspect his warships. A ship is a fragile thing in a dangerous element, vulnerable to spells and hexes. As soon as Hound came aboard the new galley, he scented something. "Well, well," he said. "Who's this?" He walked to the helm and put his hand on it. "This is clever," he said. "But who is it?" "A newcomer, I think." He sniffed appreciatively. "Very clever," he said. They came to a house in Boatwright Street after dark. They kicked the door in, and Hound, standing among the armed and armored men, said, "Him, let the others be." And to Otter he said, "Don't move," in a low, amicable voice. He sensed great power in the young man, enough that he was a little afraid of him. But Otter's distress was too great and his training too slight for him to think of using magic to free himself or stop the men's brutality. He flung himself at them and fought them like an animal till they knocked him on the head. They broke Otter's father's jaw and beat his aunt and mother senseless to teach them not to bring up crafty men. Then they carried Otter away. Not a door opened in the narrow street. Nobody looked out to see what the noise was. Not till long after the men were gone did some neighbors creep out to comfort Otter's people as best they could. "Oh, it's a curse, this wizardry," they said. Hound told his master that they had the hexer in a safe place, and Loson said, "Who was he working for?" "He worked in your shipyard, your highness." Loson liked to be called by kingly titles. "Who hired him to hex the ship, fool?" "It seems it was his own idea, your majesty." "Why? What was he going to get out of it?" Hound shrugged. He didn't choose to tell Loson that people hated him disinterestedly. "He's crafty, you say. Can you use him?"
"I can try, your highness."
"Tame him or bury him," said Loson, and turned to more important matters. Otter's humble teachers had taught him pride. They had trained into him a deep contempt for wizards who worked for such men as Loson, letting fear or greed pervert magic to evil ends. Nothing, to his mind, could be more despicable than such a betrayal of their art. So it troubled him that he couldn't despise Hound. He had been stowed in a storeroom of one of the old palaces that Loson had appropriated. It had no window. Its door was cross-grained oak, barred with iron, and spells had been laid on that door that would have kept a far more experienced wizard captive.
There were men of great skill and power in Lothen's pay. Hound did not consider himself to be one of them.
All I have is a nose, he said.
He came daily to see that Otter was recovering from his concussion and dislocated shoulder, and to talk with him. He was, as far as Otter could see, well-meaning and honest.
If you won't work for us, they'll kill you, he said. Lothen can't have fellows like you on the loose.
You'd better hire on while he'll take you.
I can't.
Otter stated it as an unfortunate fact, not as a moral assertion. Hound looked at him with appreciation. Living with the pirate king, he was sick of boasts and threats, of boasters and threateners.
What are you strongest in?
Otter was reluctant to answer. He had to like Hound, but he didn't have to trust him.
Shape-changing?
He mumbled at last.
Shape-taking?
No, just tricks. Turn a leaf to a gold piece, seemingly. In those days, they had no fixed names for the various kinds and arts of magic, nor were the connections among those arts clear. There was, as the wise men of Roke would say later, no science in what they knew. But Hound knew pretty surely that his prisoner was concealing his talents.
Can't change your own form?
Even seemingly? Otter shrugged. It was hard for him to lie. He thought he was awkward at it because he had no practice. Hound knew better. He knew that magic itself resists untruth. Conjuring, sleight of hand, and false commerce with the dead are counterfeits of magic, glass to the diamond, brass to the gold. They are fraud, and lies flourish in that soil. But the art of magic, though it may be used for false ends, deals with what is real, and the words it works with are the true words, so true wizards find it hard to lie about their art. In their heart they know that their lie, spoken, may change the world. Hound was sorry for him.
You know, if it was Gellert questioning you, he'd have everything you know out of you just with a word or two, and your wits with it. I've seen what old Whiteface leaves behind when he asks questions.
Listen, can you work with the wind at all? Otter hesitated and said, yes.
Do you have a bag?
Weather workers used to carry a leather sack in which they said they kept the winds, untying it to let a fair wind loose or to capture a contrary one. Maybe it was only for show, but every weather worker had a bag, a great long sack, or a little pouch. At home, Otter said. It wasn't a lie. He did have a pouch at home. He kept his fine work tools and his bubble level in it. And he wasn't altogether lying about the wind. Several times he had managed to bring a bit of mage wind into the sail of a boat, though he had no idea how to combat or control a storm, as a ship's weather worker must do. But he thought he'd rather drown in a gale than be murdered in this hole.
But you wouldn't be willing to use that skill in the king's service?
There is no king in Earthsea, the young man said, stern and righteous.
In my master's service, then?
Hound amended, patient. No, Otter said, and hesitated. He felt he owed this man an explanation. See, it's not so much won't as can't. I thought of making plugs in the planking of that galley, near the keel. You know what I mean by plugs. They'd work out as the timbers work when she gets in a heavy sea.
Hound nodded.
But I couldn't do it. I'm a shipbuilder. I can't build a ship to sink. With men aboard her, my hands wouldn't do it. So I did what I could. I made her go her own way. Not his way.
Hound smiled. They haven't undone what you did yet either, he said. Old Whiteface was crawling all over her yesterday, growling and muttering. Ordered the helm replaced.
He meant Lothen's chief mage, a pale man from the north named Gellert, who was much feared in Havnor.
That won't do it. Could you undo that spell?
A flicker of complacency showed in Otter's tired, battered young face. No, he said. I don't think anybody can.
Too bad. You might have used that to bargain with.
Otter said nothing.
A nose now is a useful thing, a saleable thing,
Hound went on.
Not that I'm looking for competition, but a finder can always find work, as they say. You ever been in a mine?
The guesswork of a wizard is close to knowledge, though he may not know what it is he knows. The first sign of Otter's gift, when he was 2 or 3 years old, was his ability to go straight to anything lost, a dropped nail, a mislaid tool, as soon as he understood the word for it. And as a boy, one of his dearest pleasures had been to go alone out into the countryside and wander along the lanes or over the hills, feeling through the soles of his bare feet and throughout his whole body the veins of water underground, the lodes and knots of ore, the lay and interfolding of the kinds of rock and earth. It was as if he walked in a great building, seeing its passages and rooms, the descents to airy caverns, the glimmer of branched silver in the walls. And as he went on, it was as if his body became the body of earth, and he knew its arteries and organs and muscles as his own. This power had been a delight to him as a boy. He had never sought any use for it. It had been his secret. He did not answer Hound's question.
"What's below us?"
Hound pointed to the floor, paved with rough slate flags. Otter was silent a while, and then said, "Clay and gravel, and under that the rock that bears garnets. All under this part of the city is that rock. I don't know the names."
"You can learn them."
"I know how to build boats, how to sail boats."
"You'll do better away from the ships, all the fighting and raiding. The king's working the old mines at Samori, round the mountain. There you'd be out of his way. Work for him you must, if you want to stay alive. I'll see that you're sent there, if you go."
After a little silence, Otter said, "Thanks," and he looked up at Hound, one brief, questioning, judging glance. Hound had taken him, had stood and seen his people beaten senseless, and had not stopped the beating. Yet he spoke as a friend. "Why?" said Otter's look. Hound answered it.
"Crafty men need to stick together," he said. "Men who have no art at all, nothing but wealth, they pit us one against the other, for their gain, not ours. We sell them our power. Why do we? We went our own way together, we'd do better. Maybe."
Hound meant well in sending the young man to Samore, but he did not understand the quality of Otter's will, nor did Otter himself. He was too used to obeying others to see that, in fact, he had always followed his own bent, and too young to believe that anything he did could kill him. He planned, as soon as they took him out of his cell, to use the old changer's spell of self-transformation and so escape. Surely his life was in danger, and it would be all right to use the spell. Only he couldn't decide what to turn himself into. A bird or a wisp of smoke, what would be safest? But Lawson's men, used to wizard's tricks, drugged his food. They dumped him into a mule cart like a sack of oats. When he showed signs of reviving during the journey, one of them bashed him on the head, remarking that he wanted to make sure he got his rest. When he came to himself, sick and weak from the poison and with an aching skull, he was in a room with brick walls and bricked-up windows. The door had no bars and no visible lock, but when he tried to get to his feet, he felt bonds of sorcery holding his body and mind, resilient, clinging, tightening as he moved. He could stand, but he could not take a step towards the door. He could not even reach his hand out. It was a horrible sensation, as if his muscles were not his own. He sat down again and tried to hold still. The spell bonds around his chest kept him from breathing deeply, and his mind felt stifled too, as if his thoughts were crowded into a space too small for them. After a long time, the door opened and several men came in. He could do nothing against them as they gagged him and bound his arms behind him.
"Now you won't weave charms nor speak spells, young'un," said a broad, strong man with a furrowed face. "But you can nod your head well enough, right? They sent you here as a dowser. If you're a good dowser, you'll feed well and sleep easy. Cinnabar, that's what you're to nod for. The king's wizard says it's still here somewhere about these old mines, and he wants it, so it's best for us that we find it. Now I'll walk you out, It's like I'm the water finder, and you're my wand, see? You lead on, and if you want to go this way or that way, you dip your head so. And when you know there's ore underfoot, you stamp on the place. So, now that's the bargain, right? And if you play fair, I will. He waited for Otter to nod, but Otter stood motionless. Sulk away, the man said. If you don't like this work, there's always the roaster. The man, whom the others called Licky, led him out into a hot, bright morning that dazzled his eyes. Leaving his cell, he had felt the spell bonds loosen and fall away, but there were other spells woven about other buildings of the place, especially around a tall stone tower, filling the air with sticky lines of resistance and repulsion. If he tried to push forward into them, his face and belly stung with jabs of agony, so that he looked in horror for the wound, but there was no wound. Gagged and bound, without his voice and hands to work the magic, he could do nothing against these spells. Licky had tied one end of a braided leather cord around his neck and held the other end, following him. He let Otter walk into a couple of the spells, and after that Otter avoided them. Where they were was plain enough, the dusty pathways bent to miss them. Leashed like a dog, he walked along, sullen and shivering with sickness and rage. He stared around him, seeing the stone tower, stacks of wood by its wide doorway, rusty wheels and machines by a pit, great heaps of gravel and clay. Turning his sore head made him dizzy. "If you're a dowser, better douse," said Licky, coming up alongside him and looking into his face. "And if you're not, you'd better douse all the same. That way you'll stay above ground longer." A man came out of the stone tower. He passed them, walking hurriedly with a queer shambling gait, staring straight ahead. His chin shone and his chest was wet with spittle leaking from his lips.
"That's the roaster tower," said Licky, "where they cook the cinnabar to get the metal from it. Roasters die in a year or two." "Where to, Dowser?"
After a bit, Otter nodded left, away from the gray stone tower. They walked on towards a long, treeless valley, past grass-grown dumps and tailings.
"All under here's worked out long since," Licky said,
and Otter had begun to be aware of the strange country under his feet. Empty shafts and rooms of dark air in the dark earth, a vertical labyrinth, the deepest pits filled with unmoving water.
"Never was much silver, and the water metal's long gone. Listen, young'un, do you even know what cinnabar is?"
Otter shook his head.
"I'll show you some. That's what Gellick's after, the ore of water metal. Water metal eats all the other metals, even gold, see? So he calls it the king. If you find him as king, he'll treat you well. He's often here. Come on, I'll show you. Dog can't track till he's had the scent."
Licky took him down into the mines to show him the Ganj, the kinds of earth the ore was likely to occur in. A few miners were working at the end of a long level. Because they were smaller than men and could move more easily in narrow places, or because they were at home with the earth, or most likely because it was the custom, women had always worked the mines of Earthsea. These miners were free women, not slaves like the workers in the roaster tower. Gellick had made him foreman over the miners, Licky said, but he did no work in the mine. The miners forbade it, earnestly believing it was the worst of bad luck for a man to pick up a shovel or shore a timber.
"Suits me," Licky said.
A shock-haired, bright-eyed woman with a candle bound to her forehead set down her pick to show Otter a little cinnabar in a bucket, brownish-red clots and crumbs. Shadows leapt across the earth face at which the miners worked. Old timbers creaked, dirt sifted down. Though the air ran cool through the darkness, the drifts and levels were so low and narrow they had to stoop and squeeze their way. In places, the ceilings had collapsed. Ladders were half-rotten. The mine was a terrifying place. Yet Otter felt a sense of shelter in it. He was half sorry to go back up into the burning day. Licky did not take him into the roasting tower, but back to the barracks. From a locked room, he brought out a small, soft,
thick leather bag that weighed heavy in his hands. He opened it to show Otter the little pool of dusty brilliance lying in it. When he closed the bag, the metal moved in it, bulging, pressing, like an animal trying to get free.
"There's the king," Licky said, in a tone that might have been reverence or hatred.
Though not a sorcerer, Licky was a much more formidable man than Hound. Yet, like Hound, he was brutal, not cruel. He demanded obedience, but nothing else. Otter had seen slaves and their masters all his life in the shipyards of Havnor, and he knew he was fortunate, at least in daylight, when Licky was his master. He could eat only in the cell where they took his gag off. Bread and onions were what they gave him, with a slop of rancid oil on the bread. Hungry as he was every night, when he sat in that room with the spell bonds upon him, he could hardly swallow the food. It tasted of metal, of ash. The nights were long and terrible, for the spells pressed on him, weighed on him, waked him over and over, terrified, gasping for breath, and never able to think. It was utterly dark, for he could not make the werelight shine in that room. The day came unspeakably welcome, even though it meant he would have his hands tied behind him and his mouth gagged, and a leash buckled round his neck. Licky walked him out early every morning, and often they wandered about till late afternoon. Licky was silent and patient. He did not ask if Otter was picking up any sign of the ore. He did not ask whether he was seeking the ore or pretending to seek it. Otter himself could not have answered the question. In these aimless wanderings, the knowledge of the underground would enter him as it had used to do, and he would try to close himself off to it. "I will not work in the service of evil," he told himself. Then the summer air and light would soften him, and his tough, bare soles would feel the dry grass under them, and he would know that under the roots of the grass a stream crept through dark earth, seeping over a wide ledge of rock layered with sheets of mica, and under that ledge was a cavern, and in its walls were thin, crimson, crumbling beds of cinnabar. He made no sign. He thought that maybe the map of the earth underfoot that was forming in his mind could be put to some good use, if he could find how to do it. But after 10 days or so, Licky said, "Master Gellick's coming here. If there's no ore for him, he'll likely find another dowser." Otter walked on a mile, brooding, then circled back, leading Licky to a hillock not far from the far end of the old workings. There he nodded downward and stamped his foot. Back in the cell room, when Licky had unleashed him and untied his gag, he said, "There's some ore there. You can get to it by running that old tunnel straight on, maybe 20 feet.
"Good bit of it?"
Otter shook his head.
"Just enough to keep going on, eh?"
Otter said nothing.
"Suits me," said Licky.
2 days later, when they had reopened the old shaft and begun digging towards the ore, the wizard arrived. Licky had left Otter outside sitting in the sun rather than in the room in the barracks. Otter was grateful to him. He could not be wholly comfortable with his hands bound and his mouth gagged, but wind and sunlight were mighty blessings, and he could breathe deep and doze without dreams of earth stopping his mouth and nostrils, the only dreams he ever had, nights in the cell. He was half asleep, sitting on the ground in the shade by the barracks, the smell of the logs stacked by the roaster tower bringing him a memory of the workyards at home, the fragrance of new wood as the plane ran down the silken oak board. Some noise or movement roused him. He looked up and saw the wizard standing before him, looming above him. Gellick wore fantastic clothes, as many of his kind did in those days. A long robe of lorbinary silk, scarlet, embroidered in gold and black with runes and symbols, and a wide-brimmed, peak-crowned hat made him seem taller than a man could be. Otter did not need his clothes to know him. He knew the hand that had woven his bonds and cursed his knights, the acid taste and choking grip of that power.
I think I've found my little finder, said Gellick.
His voice was deep and soft, like the notes of a viol.
Sleeping in the sunshine, like one whose work has been well done. So you've sent them digging for the Red Mother, have you? Did you know the Red Mother before you came here? Are you a courtier of the king? Here now, there's no need for ropes and knots.
Where he stood, with a flick of his finger, he untied Otter's wrist, and the gagging kerchief fell loose.
I could teach you how to do that for yourself, the wizard said, smiling, watching Otter rub and flex his aching wrists and work his lips that had been smashed against his teeth for hours. The hound told me that you're a lad of promise and might go far with a proper guide. If you'd like to visit the court of the king, I can take you there. But maybe you don't know the king I'm talking of.
Indeed, Otter was unsure whether the wizard meant the pirate or the quicksilver. But he risked a guess and made one quick gesture toward the stone tower. The wizard's eyes narrowed and his smile broadened.
Do you know his name?
The water metal, Otter said.
So the vulgar call it, or quicksilver, or the water of weight. But those who serve him call him the king and the all-king, and the body of the moon.
His gaze, benevolent and inquisitive, passed over Otter into the tower and then back. His face was large and long, whiter than any face Otter had seen, with bluish eyes. Gray and black hairs curled here and there on his chin and cheeks. His calm, open smile showed small teeth, several of them missing.
Those who have learned to see truly can see him as he is, the lord of all substances. The root of power lies in him. Do you know what we call him in the secrecy of his palace?
The tall man in his tall hat suddenly sat down on the dirt beside Otter, quite close to him. His breath smelled earthy. His light eyes gazed directly into Otter's eyes.
Would you like to know? You can know anything you like. I need have no secrets from you. Nor you for me.
And he laughed, not threateningly, but with pleasure. He gazed at Otter again, his large white face smooth and thoughtful.
Powers you have, yes. All kinds of little traits and tricks. Clever lad. But not too clever, that's good.
Not too clever to learn, like some.
I'll teach you if you like. Do you like learning? Do you like knowledge? Would you like to know the name we call the king when he's all alone in his brightness in his courts of stone? His name, Turris. Do you know that name?
It's a word in the language of the All-King, his own name in his own language. In our base tongue, we would say seaman. He smiled again, patted Otter's hand, for he is the seed and the fructifier. The seed and the source of might and right. You'll see, you'll see. Come along, come along. Let's go see the king flying among his subjects, gathering himself from them.
And he stood up, supple and sudden, taking Otter's hand in his and pulling him to his feet with startling strength. He was laughing with excitement.
Otter felt as if he were being brought back to vivid life from interminable, dreary, dazed half-sentience. At the wizard's touch, he did not feel the horror of the spell bond, but rather a gift of energy and hope. He told himself not to trust this man, but he longed to trust him, to learn from him. Gellick was powerful, masterful, strange, yet he had set him free. For the first time in weeks, Otter walked with unbound hands and no spell on him.
This way, Gellick murmured. No harm will come to you.
They had come to the doorway of the roaster tower, a narrow passage in the 3-foot-thick walls. He took Otter's arm, for the young man hesitated. Licky had told him it was the fumes of the metal rising from heated ore that sickened and killed the people who worked in the tower. Otter had never entered it, nor seen Licky enter it. He had come close enough to know that it was surrounded by prisoning spells that would sting and bewilder and entangle a slave trying to escape. Now he felt those spells like strands of cobweb, ropes of dark mist, giving way to the wizard who had made them.
"Breathe, breathe, breathe,"
Gellick said, laughing. And Otter tried not to hold his breath as they entered the tower. The roasting pit took up the center of a huge domed chamber. Hurrying stick-like figures, black against the blaze, shoveled and reshoveled ore onto logs kept in a roaring blaze by great bellows, while others brought fresh logs and worked the bellows' sleeves. From the apex of the dome, a spiral of chambers rose up into the tower through smoke and fumes. In those chambers, Licky had told him, the vapor of the quicksilver was trapped and condensed, reheated and recondensed, till in the topmost vault, the pure metal ran down into a stone trough or bowl. Only a drop or two a day, he said, from the low-grade ores they were roasting now.
Don't be afraid, Gellick said,
his voice strong and musical over the panting gasp of the huge bellows and the steady roar of the fire.
Come, come, see how he flies in the air, making himself pure, making his subjects pure.
He drew Otter to the edge of the roasting pit. His eyes shone in the flare and dazzle of the flames.
Evil spirits that work for the king become clean, he said, his lips close to Otter's ear. As they slaver, the dross and stains flow out of them. Illness and impurities fester and run free from their sores. And then, when they're burned clean, at last they can fly up into the courts of the king. Come along. Come along up into his tower, where the dark night brings forth the moon.
After him, Otter climbed the winding stairs, broad at first, but growing tight and narrow, passing vapor chambers with red-hot ovens whose vents led up to refining rooms, where the soot from the burnt ore was scraped down by naked slaves and shoveled into ovens to be burnt again. They came to the topmost room. Gellick said to a single slave crouching at the rim of the shaft,
"Show me the king."
The slave, short and thin, hairless, with running sores on his hands and arms, uncapped a stone cup by the rim of the condensing shaft. Gellick peered in, eager as a child.
"So tiny," he murmured, "so young, the tiny prince, the baby lord, Lord Turris, seed of the world, soul jewel."
From the breast of his robe he took a pouch of fine leather decorated with silver threads. With a delicate horn spoon tied to the pouch, he lifted the few drops of quicksilver from the cup and placed them in it, then retied the thong. The slave stood by, motionless. All the people who worked in the heat and fumes of the roaster tower were naked, or wore only breech clout and moccasins. Otter glanced again at the slave, thinking by his height he was a child, and then saw the small breast. It was a woman. She was bald. Her joints were swollen knobs in her bone-thin limbs. She looked up once at Otter, moving her eyes only. She spat into the fire, wiped her sore mouth with her hand, and stood motionless again.
"That's right, little servant, well done," Gellick said to her in his tender voice. "Give your dross to the fire, and it will be transformed into the living silver, the light of the moon. Is it not a wonderful thing?" he went on, drawing Otter away and back down the spiral stair. "How from what is most base comes what is most noble. That is a great principle of the art. From the vile red mother is born the all-king. From the spittle of a dying slave is made the silver seed of power."
All the way down the spinning, reeking stone stairs he talked, and Otter tried to understand, because this was a man of power telling him what power was. But when they came out into the daylight again, his head kept on spinning in the dark, and after a few steps, he doubled over and vomited on the ground. Gellick watched him with his inquisitive, affectionate look, and when Otter stood up, wincing and gasping, the wizard asked gently,
"Are you afraid of the king?"
Otter nodded.
"If you share his power, he won't harm you. To fear a power, to fight a power, is very dangerous. To love power and to share it is the royal way. Look, watch what I do."
Gellick held up the pouch into which he had put the few drops of quicksilver. His eye always on Otter's eye, he unsealed the pouch, lifted it to his lips, and drank its contents. He opened his smiling mouth so that Otter could see the silver drops pooling on his tongue before he swallowed. "Now the king is in my body, the noble guest of my house. He won't make me slaver and vomit or cause sores on my body. No, for I don't fear him, but invite him. And so he enters into my veins and arteries. No harm comes to me. My blood runs silver. I see things unknown to other men. I share the secrets of the king. And when he leaves me, he hides in the place of ordure, in foulness itself. And yet again, in the vile place, he waits for me to come and take him up and cleanse him as he cleansed me, so that each time we grow purer together." The wizard took Otter's arm and walked along with him. He said, smiling and confidential, "I am one who shits moonlight. You will not know another such. And more than that, the king enters into my seed. He is my semen. I am Taurus, and he is me." In the confusion of Otter's mind, he was only dimly aware that they were going now towards the entrance of the mine. They went underground. The passages of the mine were a dark maze, like the wizard's words. Otter stumbled on, trying to understand. He saw the slave in the tower, the woman who had looked at him. He saw her eyes. They walked without light, except for the faint ware-like Gellick sent before them. They went through long disused levels, which the wizard seemed to know every step of. Or perhaps he did not know the way, and was wandering without heed. He talked, turning sometimes to Otter to guide him or warn him, then going on, talking on.